Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Rebecca Godfrey is an award-winning novelist and journalist. Her first novel, The Torn Skirt, was a national bestseller and a finalist for the Ethel Wilson Fiction Prize. Under the Bridge, Godfrey's shocking true story of a group of teenagers who savagely beat a classmate to death and then tried to cover up the crime, received one of Canada's largest literary awards, the British Columbia Award for Canadian Nonfiction, as well as the Arthur Ellis Award for Excellence in Crime Writing. Under the Bridge is now, has just been re-released. It's in paperback. Rebecca Godfrey will talk with the amazing author Gary Steingart at Oblong Books in Rhinebeck this Saturday at 6 p.m. The new book is, well, the new version of the book is Under the Bridge, and it is published by Gallery Books from Simon & Schuster, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Rebecca Godfrey to the program. How are you?
I'm good.
So give me a sense of how a book that comes out in 2005 is rescued, is brought out again and put in a new edition. How does that happen?
Yeah, I'm not sure how it happened, but I'm happy it did. I think, you know, when the book initially came out in 2005, it did receive a lot of attention. It was a very high-profile crime, and this was the first book on the crime. But I also think at that time there was a bit of stigma around true crime. And so, you know, you would think of a true crime book and think of those books with the ripped wedding portrait and blood trickling down, or
right,
know, sort of airport trashy books. So there wasn't that interest that there is now from, you know, more sophisticated sort of readers. So I think they thought, the publisher thought, there is so much interest in true crime, and this is one not a lot of people know about, and it does take an approach similar to Serial or those kinds of
investigations. Yeah. So let's look at, before we get into the story itself here, I find this fascinating because this is, we often hear that these are stories that people say, oh, well, I didn't know about that. It's not one that hit the headlines. Do we know why that's the case? I mean, what is it about a story of the ingredients that come together that make, you know, let's say a JonBenet Ramsey case versus another child who is murdered? What is it about a certain case, do you think, where those ingredients are missing that it flies below the radar, and a horrific crime, as you write about in this book, isn't national news?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. This case, actually, it was a huge story at the time because it happened in 97, and it was it was in the New York Times and CNN, and because I think of the nature of girls being involved, it was very unusual. But I think, you know, certain stories just resonate with people, partly because if there's an unexpected twist, like in this case, I think usually when you hear about a young girl being murdered, there's the creepy older man arrested.
Right.
And here it was these girls that sort of looked like they could be in any suburban high school.
And that really is the story here, that we're looking at teen-on-teen crime,
right,
which was horrific.
Yes.
So the other thing that I find fascinating is that, as I mentioned, the book was written in 2005. The actual event happened in 1997. How long after that did you start to work on telling this story?
Very soon. I read about it. As I said, I was living in New York and had finished grad school at Sarah Lawrence and was working sort of freelance writing and editing, and read about this in the New York Times. And I think the headline was Grizzly Slaying of Girl 14 Startles a Small Town. And it was my small town where I'd grown up. So that was very strange, you know, to see your own little town in the New York Times for a murder. It's a very beautiful sort of tourist town. I don't think anyone was murdered the entire time I lived there. So I went back for Christmas and started just going to the courthouse and asking people I knew if they knew anything, because at the time it was very hush-hush. The teenagers, they had arrested eight teenagers, and none of them were talking to the media. They all had very different stories. So I started, you know, very soon after interviewing and trying to learn what had actually happened.
The victim was Rena Virk. She was how old?
14.
14 years old. Beat and drowned. And then this group of teenagers, mostly girls, they try to hide the crime from their parents, teachers, detectives. And that goes on for how long, roughly?
8 days.
8 days. And when do things start to unravel?
Well, what happened was the Rena Virk was invited to a party. These kids always partied at the high school field. And there was initially an assault, which all the kids had, some kids had planned. You know, we're going to get this girl back for telling stories about us. And so there was a fight that a lot of kids witnessed and ran away from and were upset by. But then they all scattered and went home.
Yeah.
And then the next day, these rumors started that Rena had been killed and Rena was missing. Her parents reported her to the police. But it's really incredible, especially, you know, this was before Facebook or social media. So these kids really whispered and talked about it, but nobody said anything to a parent until finally two sort of street smart girls heard about it and were so appalled that they went to the police. And at that point, first the police went back to the high school the fall, you know, a week later, the Friday night, and started arresting the kids. And then they still didn't find the body. They found the body the next day.
So for you as a person who grew up in that town, did you go to the same school?
No.
No. So you grew up in that town. Did it resonate with you that as you were starting to unpeel the layers, that this could happen where you lived? I mean, a lot of people would say, oh, you know, I had no idea that my son or daughter was doing this. It happened right under my nose. I had no idea. When you came in, were you of that mindset or were you thinking, oh, yeah, I saw ripples of this when I was a kid?
Yeah, definitely. I did see ripples. And I had written a novel called The Torn Skirt,
right,
that sort of looked at runaway girls or the sort of underbelly of this picture-perfect tourist town. So I was already aware that the town, you know, is a colonial town that is named after the queen and has tea rooms, and that there was a whole other
rooms, for God's sake.
Yeah.
You can't have a murder.
So, yeah. So I was aware there was, like, a whole other side to this town, but it's still very surprising to you know, learn who these kids were and what they'd done.
It's in British Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
And tell us a little bit about the town.
The town's called Victoria. It's kind of confusing because it's on Vancouver Island.
Yep.
But it is not Vancouver. It's a very small town. And it's, as I said, a lot of British families with beautiful gardens and very proper. And it's also very scenic because it's this island with mountain views and ocean. You know, it's just has this sort of wildness as well as this formal British side. So
when I got to visit there once, and I was surprised that it was I don't know, there was a royal visit happening
while we were
visiting. So apparently that is a common thing semi-common.
Yeah, Di and Charles came there. Yeah, and there's still, you know, Queen Elizabeth.
Yeah,
portraits everywhere you go.
Yeah. So then, you saw the ripples, you saw the kid. Did you have any knowledge, familial knowledge, meaning of the families that were involved of any of the girls, the suspects, or of the victim?
No, and that was interesting for me because I had grown up there and sort of thought I knew the town. And this murder happened in a suburb called View Royal that was near the docks. It was a more working class.
Yeah.
Suburb, and I'd actually never been there in my life, and so I had to kind of figure out that world, which was quite different than where I grew up, which was a more academic base, you know, it was near the university. But I didn't have family connections, but it is a small town, so I knew, you know, my high school friend's brother was telling me, my brother, you got to talk to him, works in the jail with all these girls. It's crazy in there. They're all fighting and, you know, they're threatening each other.
Right.
And then another friend's father was the social worker for the accused girl who was ultimately accused of murder. So I had definitely connections that I wouldn't have had if I just gone as a reporter to Texas or somewhere.
And well, that's the thing of a small town, right?
Right.
I mean, eventually somebody's going to say to you, well, you know, it's the Gunderson, like what
totally,
do you expect,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So from my understanding, 12 years had passed from the time you left to the time you returned. You were an arts reporter. You come back
right.
at 29, 30 years old. And so 12 years had passed since you left the town, so a lot changes in a decade plus.
Yeah, it was different, but, you know, still the high schools, and I think these are high schools everywhere. My friend Sarah is with me, and she read my first book and said it, you know, reminded her of her high school. So there's sort of, you know, every high school at that point had these sort of groups of the tough girls and the cheerleaders and this and that. But these girls, you know, were very... I guess by that point, it was hip-hop had become really popular
mm-hmm.
with kids. So there was this whole, like, swagger, you know, hip-hop talk, acting like gangsters, saying you were in the Crips and Bloods, and that was certainly very different than when I grew up. We did not have that sort of gang infatuation.
In the time that we have left, give us a sense of how much of the story was known and how much you were able to unveil.
Well, there definitely was a public narrative that was on the news, you know, that this was a misfit girl who was attacked by eight teenagers, and they covered it up. And that was really about it. There really wasn't any kind of human detail about who these kids were because I was the first to talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think just in terms of who are these characters, sort of I went behind the headlines and really portrayed them, what their lives have been like, their parents, their friendships, their loves. And in terms of the murder, I definitely did find new evidence. And I think I got a fuller picture of who was guilty because of the new evidence, which was certain documents I got a hold of that weren't public, and also teenagers telling me things that I could verify that they had seen on the night of the murder.
You have an afterword in the book, a new afterword, and so in 2017 you go back and you visit the women in prison. They still maintain their innocence.
Well, the main girl, I don't want to do a spoiler, but
no.
The main girl, so ultimately a teenage boy and teenage girl were charged with a murder that took place after this assault, that they had followed Rena Virk across the bridge, beat her, and drowned her again. And the boy said the girl did it all, and he was just an innocent bystander. And the girl said she didn't do it at all. She wasn't there. She was framed. And she maintained that really up until a year ago, that she was innocent. So only in the past year, she somehow got pregnant in prison and I think had a child and really wanted to get out. And to do that, you have to acknowledge guilt.
I want to read a line from the afterword and just as our final moment together. In View Royal, the murder of Rena Virk still resonates, haunting the community in the manner of a myth or a ghost story. Yet, although the case shone light on a hidden world of vulnerable, volatile, and often abandoned teenagers, there's been little systemic effort to provide guidance or shelter. It seems, other than the tragedy itself, that is a tragedy.
Yes, definitely.
And that goes back to what we say on many issues about many different things of learning the lessons of the past.
Right.
And I guess, are there, to your knowledge, I mean, are there places that have taken these tragedies and have been able to make some sort of systemic change?
I think there was a very effective anti-bullying program that started by a couple of police officers.
Yep.
And I do think that really was effective. And, you know, that bullying became a word now that everyone's familiar with. But at the time of this murder, it wasn't discussed. It was sort of, I remember in high school, there were fights every day. And it was just like fight. And it was fun. You know, nobody blinked. So I think it definitely created an awareness of bullying. And a lot of kids still study this book and talk about it with their teachers. And, you know, there's a sense of, this can go somewhere. You know, it's not harmless. It just the cruelty can really be, change everyone's lives. So I think that that was effective in terms of programs for the girls. I really wish there were more.
Mm. You will be in conversation with the ever wonderful Gary Steingart,
yes,
and at Oblong Books in Rhinebeck, New York, this Saturday. Gary has a new book out called Lake Success, which is lovely, but you will be talking about your book with Gary at Oblong Books in Rhinebeck, New York, this Saturday at 6 p.m. Oblongbooks.com. Oblongbooks.com. And oddly, Susanna Hermans will be here in just a few minutes to do his book pick. So it all comes together.
Yes, and Gary will be playing the part of a bad cop.
Oh, is that the roles you're playing? Good cop, bad cop?
No, I'm the bad teen.
Oh, you're
the
bad teen.
Yeah.
What are you doing, a pageant? What, it's not a reading? What are,
no, we're going to act out one of the interrogation scenes.
Yeah. Well, quite an evening.
Yeah.
It's all Saturday at 6 o'clock, oblongbooks.com. Rebecca Godfrey, a great pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Delight to have you here. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.